John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drop?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, July 25th, 2012. Israel plans to take over East Jerusalem and raid several neighborhoods in the Hebron area. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Tuesday, Israel announced plans to take full municipal control of a section of East Jerusalem that lies on the other side of the annexation wall. Israeli officials in Tel Aviv have been discussing taking full control of the rest of East Jerusalem for several years. Their latest plan will bring portions of the city suburbs that lie east of the wall under Israeli jurisdiction, reports Ma'an News. On Wednesday, Israeli forces raided several neighborhoods in the area in and around Hebron, and 9 Palestinians were detained, while Israeli settlers simultaneously attacked Palestinians, according to reports from Wafa and PNN. In Hebron, 8 Palestinians were detained, and settlers attacked several others. Settlers also attacked Palestinians from the village of Susia. And in Beit Umar, a Palestinian teenager was arrested, bringing the total number of children arrested by Israeli soldiers from that village to 45. In the town of Al-Hadr Tuesday, a group of Israeli settlers erected a military tower on agricultural land in the West Bank, according to Wafa News. The coordinator of the Popular Committee Against Settlements in Al-Hadr, Ahmed Salah, said that settlers put up a 10-meter military tower in an agricultural area just west of the town while under the protection of the Israeli military. A mobile home was also placed there a week ago by Israeli soldiers as part of an effort to monitor and control farmers in the area. And finally, the body of Jihad Abu Shalouf, 22, a Palestinian killed by Israel at the border, was returned to Gaza today, 2 weeks after his death, according to Ma'an News. Israeli soldiers opened fire on a group of 4 workers trying to enter Israel by traveling through Egypt. Of the 3 workers with Shalouf, 1 was shot and killed immediately, while the 2 others were arrested. Following the incident, Israeli military officials said that all 4 men were unarmed. And that's all for today from IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, July 25th Daily News Roundup from the Occupied Palestinian Territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Kelly Joyner.
Afghanistan, 22nd of July. An unknown fighter wearing a uniform of Afghan soldiers or police opened fire on foreign troops, killing three NATO trainers of unspecified nationality. Afghanistan, 21st and 22nd of July. Five NATO soldiers of unreported nationality were killed by roadside bombs in just 2 days. Afghanistan reported 21st of July. The Taliban executed five jailers for collaborating with NATO occupation troops. A sixth jailer escaped. Pakistan, 23rd of July. A U.S. drone strike killed 13 people in North Waziristan. The drone fired 8 missiles into a house in Shawal area of the agency, killing 13 people in the attack. Quote, fear prevailed in the area as more drones are still flying in the air, anonymous sources added. Afghanistan, 25th of July. 20 Afghan guards working for Australian occupation troops defected to the Taliban in southern Afghanistan after a dispute with the soldiers, according to local police. Quote, the Australian soldiers beat the Afghan guards after some verbal disputes in a military camp in Trichino District over Rugzan Province, District Police Chief Wally Dad said on Wednesday. The angry guards set the security towers on fire and defected to the Taliban, taking weapons and ammunition, he reported. The defection occurred 2 days after a police chief and 12 of his men took weapons and joined the Taliban in Western Farah Province. Afghanistan, 23rd of July. An Afghan police commander and 12 junior officers defected to the Taliban after poisoning 7 other police officers, according to government officials in Farah Province. The commander, named only as Mirwais, was in charge of a checkpoint in the Bala Bolak district when he and his unit defected to the Taliban and handed over their equipment and weapons, including military vehicles. The 7 police were poisoned because they refused to join the rebellion, reported Abdul Rahman Zawandi, a spokesman for the Farah governor. All were taken to Farah Hospital. Sounds like this war is falling apart. Meanwhile, bloody sectarian warfare continues in Iraq, even though U.S. troops have left. It can only be described as Batman every day in Baghdad, it seems right now. Iraq, 23rd of July. At least 107 people were killed and 268 people wounded in a coordinated series of both bomb and shooting attacks. In Kirkuk alone, there were 5 car bombs. In Baghdad, there were 2 car bombs in Sadr City and other attacks all over the country. Iraq, 22nd of July. At least 20 people were killed and 80 people wounded by car bombs in 2 towns south of Baghdad and in Najaf. All of these attacks over a 2-day period appear to be sectarian attacks aimed at Iraqi Shiites, except for those aimed at police responding to the rest of the bombings. Mr. Barack Obama, Iraq is no role model for Afghanistan. What is happening there today is a result of 8 years of U.S. occupation. Afghanistan is and will be no different. There is nothing U.S. troops can do except make it worse. Bring all the troops home today, not 2 years after the election in 2014.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
The Eurozone crisis continues, with Spain recently paying the second highest interest rate to support its debt since the founding of the euro currency, with the prospect that Madrid will need an emergency cash infusion soon to avoid crashing. The trouble in Spain comes as the Greek economy, the focus of multiple previous bailout and austerity plans, shrinking 6.9% last year, with a further contraction of 6.7% predicted for 2012. While the so-called Troika, made up of the European Union, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank, failed to veer away from their austerity policies that have weakened many of the continent's major economies and increased the unemployment rate, militant anti-austerity street protests in Spain, Greece, and other nations speak to widespread and growing opposition to the Eurozone's economic course. Resistance to Europe's austerity measures have been given political expression in Greece, where Syriza, the Greek coalition of the Radical Left Party, now stands as the major opposition force to a newly elected conservative-led government in the Greek parliament. Refusing to meet with representatives of the Troika, Syriza's leader, Alexis Tsipras, declared that no political party should meet with officials of the three institutions, as they've only come to Greece to enforce their catastrophic recipes that have led the country to the cliff's edge. Your reporter spoke with Joanne Landy, co-director of the U.S.-based Campaign for Peace and Democracy, who just returned from a fact-finding trip to Greece, and discusses what lessons U.S. progressives can learn from the Greek political movements resisting austerity.
Unemployment is 25%, and for youth, it's 50%. So you can imagine what that does to a society. As one person told us, society is dying. As far as the privatization or the sell-off of assets, that's very much in contention now. And that's one of the chief things that Tsipras and Syriza are raising. They're protesting the sale of these public assets. And it's not by any means yet a done deal. And it's interesting, the way the government is trying to meet the demands of the Troika, since they're afraid to cut pensions and salaries anymore, is by raising money through the privatization sales. But that's being challenged by Syriza, and I think the whole scenario is now an open question of what's going to happen next.
Joanne, tell us about the Syriza Party, its rise in recent elections, as well as its program. What has attracted such a large amount of new support for the party and a rejection of the two major parties?
Well, they have had a meteoric ascent. They went from getting typically 3-4% of the vote to getting 27% of the vote in the June 16th or June 17th elections. The reason that they got this incredible burst of support was because they were the only party that was saying no to the memorandum, and at the same time had roots in the emerging social movements that have taken place across Greece for the last few years. And what people repeatedly told us was that Syriza had credibility because it had been there when the students were out on strike, when the occupation was going on in the squares, when workers were on strike. Syriza was always there. And they combined the participation in these movements with parliamentary representation of the demands of those movements. And I think it's that combination. It was really very exciting for me and Tom to see. We certainly wish we could have something like that in this country, where you would have not anti-politics of activists, but a complementarity between movements in the streets and parliamentary representation.
From the point of view of having a pragmatic program that can go a long way to fixing the enormous economic depression in Greece, what is Syriza saying in terms of how they can viably address the nightmare economics in Greece?
Well, that's, of course, the $64 billion question. And we frankly didn't get complete answers to that question. We know that they would nationalize the banks, that they would take control of some of the industries, that they would roll back the cuts in pensions, the firings of public employees, and so forth. But how would they do that, and what relationship would they have to Europe? I don't know. And I tried to find out. We tried to find out when we were there. We understand that they have economists and political leaders meeting to discuss this. I mean, you have to understand, this is a party with 15,000 members, which is very small, that's been catapulted into this position of potential power and responsibility. But what's encouraging about them is that they're willing to go against the stream. They're willing to reject the memorandum and the troika that's being imposed upon them, and to simultaneously do the best they can at home, and also, and I think this is key, to reach out for a new kind of Europe. They know that over the long run, they can't really solve these problems in Greece alone, that you can't, so to speak, have socialism in one country. So they've, you know, sent people around to different countries of Europe. They, right now, have called for the current government to stop talks with the Troika and to convene a European summit for a different way to respond to austerity throughout Europe.
What are the lessons that you found could be useful for progressive movements here in the United States from the activists in the resistance movement to austerity in Greece, if you could put it in a nutshell?
We really have to break out of this two-party system in which neither one of them is structurally capable of representing the movement. And although we have many more electoral obstacles than countries in Europe, which generally have proportional representation, I don't think we can let those obstacles stand in our way. And although we're not going to create a party overnight, Tom Harrison wrote an article in the for New Politics that's online talking about how progressives and the left need to make a declaration of independence from the Democratic Party. And I think that's the lesson that I would take away from this, the immediate lesson, is not that we can create a party, but that people who understand that this is a dead end say so, and then buttress their arguments with the exciting first steps that are being taken in Greece.
That was Joanne Landy, co-director of the U.S.-based Campaign for Peace and Democracy. Find links to more analysis of the Eurozone crisis and resistance movements on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Late July 2012, the International AIDS Conference came to the United States for the first time in 23 years. During a time in which the U.S. government denied visas to people who tested positive for HIV, the scientists researching AIDS refused to meet in the United States at their international convention. Unfortunately, sex workers from other nations who were supposed to participate in this conference were still denied visas and turned away at the border. On the 22nd of July, thousands marched on Washington, marking the opening of the convention and demanding that rich countries like the United States stop cutting funding for AIDS research and treatment.
It is good that this international conference returned to the United States. It's good that we, as people who live with HIV, can freely enter again this country without the fear of being deported just because we have HIV. But they forgot something. The U.S. government has denied dozens and probably hundreds of visas to this conference, to sex workers, to sex work activists who are also fighting for the right to access healthcare services and HIV prevention tools.
Cambodia.
And for treatment for all, including drug users, sex workers, and men who have sex treatment.
Ecuador.
Montserrat Galindo. Discrimination against indigenous people is fueling the spread of AIDS. We cannot allow racism to kill our people.
Rwanda.
Nina, the face of Rwanda is female. Our women need to be empowered to stop the AIDS in our country.
Yes. The Netherlands.
Thomas Rees. The Netherlands has led the world in battling HIV, but despite being one of the richest countries in Europe, it's pulling back funding. Holland, the war against AIDS has not been won.
Guyana, Hillary, in Guyana, stigma hurts the individual and the nation. People would rather hide their status and get sick than tell their families they are positive.
Zambia,
Victoria, the life expectancy of Zambia is 49. With governments committed this year, we say to the donors, keep your promise to fight HIV and AIDS.
Reverend Al Sharpton called out hypocrites in the church, those who prescribe hatred, bigotry, and homophobia instead of medicine for AIDS.
One of the things that we have to deal with is the hypocrisy in the church community. Those in the faith community that have not dealt with the issue because of their own bias and their own homophobia and their own misconception of what this is. Don't quote scriptures out of context. Jesus healed people. He didn't interview people. He never asked people why they were sick. All he asked is, do you want to be made whole? Your job, Reverend, your job, Rabbi, your job, Imam, is not to condemn people, it's to heal people. And if you are not down with the healing, you need to turn in your collar and get another kind of vocation. Those that are in elected office, you do not balance budgets on the backs of those whose health should be a right and not a privilege. When we see right in this country how people fought against an affordable health care, fight against their own.
I gotta make legs.
How can you go, you right wingers, to the hill and vote against Medicare? We know you don't like Obama, but I thought you loved your mama.
Oh!
So here we are, where you got Obama fighting health care, those that are fighting on one side of the aisle to increase budgets and increase health care. Others on the other side that act like tax cuts to the rich is all right. Outsourcing is all right. But if we want to deal with those that are in a situation that is in all of our interest to heal, all of a sudden you got to get a numbers cruncher. That's why we march today. We march for those that stand up for what is right.
On the 24th of July, one of five legs of the We Can't End AIDS march demanded an end to putting people in prison for having HIV. They went to a UPS store over a donation to Representative Rayburn, who has cut off federal funds for needle exchange programs, then on to Wells Fargo Bank, infamous investor in private prisons through the GEO Group. The march started out on K Street, wall to wall, blocking all the lanes and the service lanes. On 13th Street, going to the UPS store. Here outside the UPS store, still can't see all of it.
Yeah, the UPS store.
offender, but the state of Louisiana says I am.
Shame.
I was convicted for failure to disclose my status.
That's why you don't take a test.
I was sentenced to 6 months in a Louisiana prison. And I am obligated to register as a sex offender for 15 years.
Just move out!
HIV criminalization works against our HIV prevention efforts and other public health goals by instituting HIV stigma as the law of the land. People with HIV should not be targets of unnecessary and unjust prosecution based on fear, ignorance, or assigning blame. HIV criminalization refers to any law or policy that makes HIV transmission or failure to share one's HIV status with a sexual partner a crime. 34 U.S. states and two territories have HIV-specific laws that explicitly criminalize behavior based on one's HIV-positive status. This is only a small handful of cases of intentional transmission of HIV have ever been identified, but a vastly greater number of people fearful of prosecution have delayed HIV screening or treatment,
like
which
me.
Erodes our progress towards the end of AIDS. We can end AIDS by repealing state laws that criminalize HIV, by urging the end of condoms, by being used as evidence of sex work, by educating police, correction officers, and prosecution departments on real groups and risk of HIV transmission. Also by urging joint CDC, Department of Justice leadership against criminalization, and by supporting federal legislation by U.S. Representative Barbara Lee's Repeal Act that affirms that HIV criminalization is not the policy of the U.S. government. People for their HIV status, drug use, or involvement in sex work greatly weaken our ability to prevent HIV and provide adequate access to health care and end the AIDS epidemic. Denying funds for syringe exchange further criminalize drug use and spreads HIV by denying drug users and their communities a well-proven program of HIV prevention. We shine this spotlight at a UPS branch to decry the political donations of this corporation to opponents of syringe exchange. Congressional games that place politics over effective public health measures. AIDS activists from all over the country have been organizing actions targeting congressional leaders and United Parcel Service for reinstating the policy that bans health organizations from using federal dollars for syringe exchange programs. UPS has been the largest funder to Representative Dindy Raper, who is responsible to placing the ban on funding.
The other target of the anti-criminalization segment of the We Can End AIDS March was Wells Fargo Bank, that notorious investor in private prisons to the GEO Group. Some at the march said the International AIDS Conference should still not have been held in the United States, despite the lifting of the ban on people with HIV entering the country, because sex workers and IV drug users who were supposed to participate in the conference were denied admission to the United States to do so. In fact, a parallel conference of sex workers had to be held in another country. Hey, Louisiana. Hey, Department of Homeland Security. Hey, United States. If you like driving people underground on the basis of their lifestyle, you'll love AIDS. You'll surely get a lot of it. On the 24th of July, the We Can't End AIDS March, which began with five separate marches swarming through D.C. streets, shutting down traffic over such issues as criminalization of people with AIDS and pharmaceutical company greed, came together like five fingers closing into a fist and marched on the White House, ending in about a dozen arrests.
Here it comes!
can't hear it. They're saying, tax the rich, end AIDS now.
Yeah, they're putting red ribbons, symbolic of AIDS, on the White House fence. And a lot of them, too.
Some of the ribbons secured money to the White House fence. Others held pill bottles or pouches filled with medicines themselves. Then came the horse cops pushing in, the deployment of all that bicycle rack fence, and essentially the same civil disobedience and arrest template that was used in the tar sands protests back in August 2011, the ones that forced Obama to say no to the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. Now people are hoping to achieve the same results on AIDS. Tape on the sidewalk. The main body of the crowd retreats, leaving any civil disobedience behind. Yep, it's there. It's a civil disobedience along the White House fence.
Standard tar sands civil disobedience template I see here.
Eventually, the park police read out their standard three warnings. They may have been audible from the civil disobedience. They certainly weren't audible from anywhere else.
I think they were just told they're under arrest. It begins.
The Washington Post reported a dozen arrests. It looked like about 15 from where I was standing.
An investigation by the Guardian newspaper reveals two-thirds of U.S. food aid to starving countries is purchased from three mega food corporations, ADM, Cargill, and Bunge. ADM won half the contracts from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for food aid in 2010 to 2011, worth $300 million. Cargill, the world's largest private company, won $96 million in food aid contracts. Since the 1950s, the United States has required that food aid provided to poor countries must be purchased, processed, or shipped by an American company. This practice, known as tied aid, has long been criticized by international development advocates for undermining the capacity of poor nations to grow their own food. In recent years, the European Union and Canada have abandoned tied aid in favor of cash assistance. Eric Munoz of Oxfam America declared that the Guardian investigation, quote, makes it abundantly clear that it is the massive multinational firms, not rural American farmers, that are the direct beneficiaries of rigged rules governing U.S. food aid programs, unquote. On Capitol Hill, lobbyists for ADM, Cargill, and Bunge are working to block any mandate that food aid be purchased near the hunger crisis zone rather than being shipped from the United States.